Hello, welcome to another episode of Off the Record. Matthew Collar here with you. And on this show, I take a little break from covering the Minnesota Vikings to talk about, well, whatever interests me, whatever catches my eye and people that I'm interested in talking with. And for this week's episode, we're talking with Rayan Ali. He is the author of NBA Jam, the book. It is a Boss Fight books presentation, and it dives deep into one of the great video games of all time, a game that I still own and still enjoy playing whenever I get a chance, NBA Jam. And Rayan, the story of NBA Jam took me on a roller coaster that I must say I did not expect as I was reading your book. It really is an incredible story, how this game came to be, how amazingly popular it was, and then the downfall of the company who created it.
I love to hear that, though. That's amazing. Yeah, no, it was really a roller coaster ride that NBA Jam had, going from a game that almost didn't even make it out into arcades, considering that the NBA were going to put the kibosh on the license right from the get-go, because of the whole arcade association, they thought it was seedy, to the game being hugely popular, to then Acclaim taking over, and then Acclaim collapsing, and then all the stuff that happened with the game later. Yeah, it had quite a ride. And Midway itself, I mean, what a run. Mortal Kombat, Terminator 2, Smash TV, NFL Blitz. I mean, so many great games. I'm so glad you enjoyed it.
Oh, it's definitely a must read for anyone, especially in our age group. If you're a millennial who grew up loving the NBA, then you will definitely want to read the book about NBA Jam. But I want to start out, Rayan, if you could set the scene in the early 90s with video games, because I was not old enough at the time to go to arcades when they were at their peak in the late 80s and early 90s. I was 6 or 7 years old, so my parents would not have been saying go to the arcade late at night or something like that. So I consumed NBA Jam largely through the Super Nintendo version and people who had it for Sega that you'd go over to their house and have tournaments and things like that. But I found it to be really fascinating reading through how arcade games were the thing when NBA Jam first came out, and it exploded as an arcade game.
Absolutely, absolutely. So yeah, so NBA Jam made its debut in 1992, late 1992, at this arcade called Dennis's Place for Games in Chicago, which was right near Midway Games' office. Now, Midway being the developer and publisher of the original NBA Jam, they were coin-op business veterans. And they had been making games for many years underneath different brands. At that point, they had just released Mortal Kombat, which was hugely popular. And they'd released a few other games before that, too, of note. Things like Narc and Smash TV and Total Carnage and some other stuff. But yeah, so at that point, arcades were really, you know, the absolute high level of what you would want in terms of video game technology. I mean, that's where you'd go in order to play the best games. And NBA Jam, when it came out, was really something special for a whole bunch of reasons, and not the least being that it was the very first arcade game to have an NBA license. And I mean, nowadays if you see an arcade game with an NBA license, it's not that big of a deal. Back then it was very different. I mean, you know, the arcades had the amazing graphics, it had the great sound, you had the communal experience of everybody going and waiting in line to play a game, you know, putting their quarter up on the bezel or putting it up on the counter, so that somebody would see that and then they'd be able to enter the game. And it was really a special time. I mean, it's so different now with how video games work. But when you go back to the early 90s and the late 80s, I mean, that whole era, I mean, really up maybe until the late 90s, arcades were really in a special, special place. When NBA Jam came out, people would line up. I mean, there were lines of people waiting to play this game, which is just staggering. I got to talk to Glenn Rice for the book, and, you know, back in the early 90s, he was on the Miami Heat. So he was in NBA Jam, and he was a big NBA Jam fan, too. So what he would do is he would wait in line at an arcade in Miami to play the game. And then at some point, he got tired of waiting and just said, okay, I'm going to go buy my own cabinet. And he had his own NBA Jam game at home. And then at some point, he's like, okay, well, I want a second one. So he had two of them. And he was somebody who's in the game. And that isn't some sort of outlier example. There's so many of them out there. Glenn Rice, Shaq, Michael Jordan, who was not in the game, was also a big fan of it. Sean Kemp had a cabinet. Larry Johnson had a cabinet, one in his house and then one in his mother's house, so two cabinets. Gary Payton. I mean, the list goes on and on. Mark Price used to play the game. So it really had a special place in terms of the arcade scene and the sports scene. But arcades themselves were really at a peak in the early 90s, and NBA Jam just came along at the right time for that business.
Yeah, well, it was very cool when I was reading through the book to run across quotes from Shaquille O'Neal, which is awesome that you got to talk with him, and all these players who, you know, would gather in the room with Shaq and play. I mean, he was talking to you about being with the Orlando Magic and the guys not going out to party, but instead gathering around and playing NBA Jam with Shaq in those Magic teams that were so awesome. And there's sort of a lore that's created, too, with not only that, with the players loving it, but also the Michael Jordan story is really fascinating because the game is built in Chicago in a warehouse, and the guy who does all the motions, all the jams and everything that they had to capture is a local street baller, right? I mean, it's just like exactly how you would picture it, but it's sort of shaped after and because of Michael Jordan, because he's at the peak of his career there and his peak of popularity, and the NBA is through the roof because of Jordan, yet he's not in the game. But there's also some lore around this too with Michael Jordan, isn't there?
Absolutely, absolutely. There's a bit of lore around Michael Jordan. Well, first off, Michael Jordan was actually in the very original pitch that the Midway team took over to the NBA. So when they first came up with the concept, they had two teams of two playing on the court, and there were Jordan Barkley versus Jordan Barkley. Now, originally, it was just this model, Willie Morris Jr., this guy who was actually a bouncer. He was a bouncer at a Chicago nightclub, and he was also playing street ball in the daytime. So Mark Turmel, the main designer of NBA Jam, found Willie Morris someplace, said, "Hey, do you want to be my game?" Willie Morris thought that this guy was kidding. He didn't really get it, but he said yes. And then eventually he was in this blue screen studio. All of his moves were being captured. He was a huge Michael Jordan fan and then ended up playing Michael Jordan and also Charles Barkley by proxy in that original version of NBA Jam. So yeah, so in that very first pitch, Michael Jordan was there. Now, of course, Michael Jordan ended up getting totally removed, or rather didn't make it in at all to the main roster that made it out to arcades because of licensing issues. So it cost too much to get Michael Jordan in the game, and it wasn't really worth it at that point. Midway didn't really have the money, and Michael Jordan's license was separate from the other players. But, you know, so Michael Jordan was such a big fan of the game, or at least somebody in his management was, that they reached out to Midway and said, "Hey, can we get a special version of the game with Michael Jordan in it?" Which is crazy when you think about it. I mean, he wasn't actually licensed for the game, but he was such a big fan that he wanted to be in the game. So, of course, the Midway team said, "Yeah, sure, of course they'll do it. I mean, these are guys in Chicago. Bulls fever is really at height. And it was such a special time for the NBA anyways." So they put together a whole version of NBA Jam that had Michael Jordan in it, and then actually some other people too. And this was just a special version for Michael Jordan and these other people. And what makes the story even crazier, that Michael Jordan has his own personalized NBA Jam cabinet somewhere, or did, is that the other people in the story were Gary Payton, who was very famous for being part of NBA Jam, but that was in Tournament Edition, that famous duo of Kevin Payton on the Sonics, that's Tournament Edition. But the other person involved in that whole Jordan thing was Ken Griffey Jr., who was also a big NBA Jam fan.
Yeah.
So Ken Griffey Jr., yeah, there's headshots out there of Ken Griffey Jr. I posted them on the Twitter before. I'll have to post them again. Of Ken Griffey Jr. getting his picture taken from different angles so he could be ahead in NBA Jam just for a special Ken Griffey Jr. version, which just blows my mind. I'm like, wow, Ken Griffey Jr. is really on the top of the world this time. All these people are on the top of the world, and they still love NBA Jam so much that they want to be part of it.
Yeah, it is amazing. Now, the internet probably still wants to know where this cabinet is that belonged to Michael Jordan. Do we have any sense for whether it exists somewhere? Does Michael still have it? Is it in storage? Is there any way we could ever create a game of NBA Jam that has Michael Jordan in it from what they did then?
So there is actually at least one cabinet out there. Actually, as far as I know, there's two of them that have Michael Jordan in it. And they're in Gary Payton's house in California somewhere. So Gary Payton did an interview a few years ago where he said that, yeah, he actually has two of the cabinets still in mint condition in this place, and he has access to that special Michael Jordan edition.
Wow.
So one of the things I did during the book, yeah, while making the book, was I asked about it, or actually this was probably after making the book, I asked about it. I was like, "Hey, whatever happened to those? Do you have any pictures? Is there anything out there? I mean, this is an urban legend that's still there." And so many of these things end up getting solved, but this is one that people still want to know about. I mean, I still really want to know about. And his management, unfortunately, never got back to me with anything beyond, yeah, let's check with Gary and we'll let you know. But I know that there's a version out there in his house. And then also Mark Strammell, that designer, he also has a board somewhere. Now, this is in storage somewhere, like you said. There's a whole bunch of boards, these arcade boards somewhere. And I think that they're a bit unlabeled or they're tucked away in boxes or something. But somewhere out there, he has access to that Michael Jordan board, too. So there's at least a few different versions out there of it. So I think somebody's going to nerf it someday, but I don't know when.
Yeah, I was going to say, that will be if I get insanely rich. Find me that version. Let's talk a little bit about Mark Trammell, because he is sort of the main character in your book. I mean, there's the group of guys who all get together, and anyone who played Jam and was looking for hidden characters has probably heard the name Mark Trammell before, or Sal DeVita, that they would know that these were guys that you could find in the game. And then there's even more famously other secret hidden characters that they would put into the game, and that would make people want to go back more and more and find them. But Trammell is really interesting to me because he's got sort of a cinematic sort of rise to fame in a way. Like, he starts off really hot as a young designer and as a kid, and he's making a lot of money, and then he's looking for his best work, and he, you know, stumbles across the NBA Jam thing, and they get the license, and then it explodes. But he was a guy that turned down an offer to work for Bill Gates to continue to work with yeah. video games. And I just find him to be a super fascinating character behind the NBA Jam story.
Super fascinating guy, yeah. So Mark Trammell, if you don't recognize the name offhand, he's responsible for NBA Jam, NFL Blitz, MLB Slugfest, NBA Ballers, Smash TV, Total Carnage, a bunch of old Apple II games. I'm sure I'm forgetting a big one just offhand. But Trammell was just really a fascinating character. So, yeah, so he's from Michigan and was, yeah, he grew up, I think, yeah, he was a teenager when he started programming games, and did it all out of his parents' basement. And this was in the 70s, I think it was the late 70s, back when this was a really new world of, you know, kids programming their own games. But he did this. I mean, he figured out how to code, and he put his own games together, and he would send them off over to California. And at that time, there was this whole thriving Apple II scene and all these new machines that were out there as far as computers went. So somebody over in California saw his work, saw some games that he made and really liked them, and then ended up buying them from him, or at least paying him royalties for it. So Trammell was maybe 16, 17 in the suburbs of Michigan, just in the regular house, and getting $10,000 a month royalty checks for working on these games. And that was just his start. So he had a really crazy life at that point. And he still had a pretty crazy run up until today. But yeah, what he did was he, you know, was in Michigan. He was programming and was kind of introverted, but he really dedicated himself to his craft. And then when the time came to choose between going to college somewhere in Michigan or going into the game business, he decided that he was just going to go all in on the game business. Mm-hmm. And then he started to change as a person, became this bigger personality. He grew out his hair. He started getting to be more social. He started to have a love for exotic cars and things like this. And he had all this money and all this excitement. And then he went from California back on over to Chicago so that he could work on video games, or rather work on arcade games. And he turned down all kinds of amazing offers down along the way. I mean, the one that I mentioned in the book, like you said, is Bill Gates. But I'm pretty sure he has a Steve Jobs story out there somewhere, too. Hmm. This is one that I haven't really pressed him on, but I'm pretty sure, yeah, he turned down working for Steve Jobs or something like that. And it's just wild thinking that's the ride that he had. And then NBA Jam came out. So Trammell is definitely somebody that I was lucky to find while making the book. I mean, you don't really get amazing protagonists from real life like that all the time, especially in the game dev business. I mean, I'm sure there's amazing game developers out there with really cool personal stories, but in terms of like big things like getting $10,000 a month in royalty checks, that doesn't happen all the time. So I was really lucky to have him as part of the project. And then, yeah, he ended up making himself the very best secret character in NBA Jam. So if you want to play as an absolute killer in NBA Jam, go with MJT March 22, and then you are set.
I'm pretty sure all of us would do the exact same thing. We would make ourselves unstoppable if we were behind NBA Jam. Can you just describe the scene? Because I really love it, of how they got to where they got to with a lot of the things that became super legendary about NBA Jam. The boom shakalaka, the on fire, having the ball on fire is also a great story that you tell in the book. And I just have this vision in my head of all these guys who are geniuses or really excellent at top of their craft or what they do, just hanging out and going through game after game after game, trying to pick out the bugs, trying to make the improvements. And some of the things that we love about Jam that made it iconic almost never made it into the game.
Absolutely, absolutely. I'd say all the big things really about NBA Jam that are iconic weren't part of the original pitch process. So what's funny is that if you go back and look at the videos that the Midway team showed to the NBA sometime in 1992 when they're trying to get the license, NBA Jam is pitched as kind of a realistic game. You know, oh, it's got these realistic dunks. It's, you know, looks all lifelike. And even though it does kind of look lifelike, you know, of course, NBA Jam takes reality to a whole different place. So, yeah, all the big things that you know, boom shakalaka, he's on fire, the crazy dunks, the announcer, Tim Kisro, I mean, the guy who's this iconic voice, all these things were never planned. They were never part of the original pitch. I mean, they were hoping to get the NBA license, but that's probably as far as they got in terms of those things. So my favorite story offhand out of those would probably be the on fire one. Mm-hmm. So the whole idea with NBA Jam was that they wanted to make it really addictive, something that you just go back and play over and over again. And the thing with the arcade business is that instead of going in and saying, okay, here's $50, here's $60, I'm going to buy a game, and then that's my game forever, you have to keep hooking them every time.
Right.
So you have to make sure that you design it in such a way that people will keep coming back to the machine. And Turmel kept thinking of new ways to improve the game. Now, at this point of the process, now this is towards the middle or the end, he'd already come up with the dunks, or they'd gotten past that point and gotten the license and whatnot, but he was looking for ways to add more. So he had this idea to do a power-up, but he's like, okay, we need to have something else in this game. And then one day, he and this programmer named Jamie Rivett decided to go out to lunch, and they went to a fast food place. They love fast food over at Midway, and they decided to go over to Burger King. So on their way to Burger King, Turmel's thinking out loud, okay, what can we do as far as power-ups go? And Jamie is also trying to think of power-up ideas too. And then Jamie loved smoke effects. He loved fire from just having that in a video game was something that he really liked. So he said, yeah, what about some kind of smoke effects or fire, something like that? So these two went over to the Burger King right near where Midway's office was, and Mark Turmel had a chicken sandwich and fries. Don't know what Jamie Rivett had, but over that lunch, they basically came up with their early idea of what would come on fire in NBA Jam. And it was just over that lunch that things really started to materialize. But when they came back, Turmel had this idea that he wanted to put it in right now, wanted to see what it looked like. And this artist on the team named Sal DeVita, who is another important character in the book, mm-hmm. He immediately saw it and was like, no, this is a stupid idea. I don't like it. This game's already unrealistic enough. And it's crazy to think that, I mean, this is something that's such an iconic part of the game that was almost never part of it in the first place. So, you know, eventually Mark Turmel convinced Sal this is a really good idea. I think it actually had something to do with how the power-up of On Fire worked. I think it was not originally three shots and you're on fire. It was probably something else. Mm-hmm. But eventually, you know, Sal saw the light. He made those graphics and everything came together. But that was one of those things that was never part of that original process. It was just because they were going to launch at Burger King that day. And Jamie was like, yeah, I love smoke effects. I love On Fire. Let's do something with it. And then now you've got that legendary thing all from just going to Burger King.
I know. And that's my entire childhood of playing street ball with my friends, is all of the sayings, the boom shakalaka, not that we could dunk, but we had a lower rim in my backyard so we could all dunk on it. And I'm sure many kids did because they wanted to emulate NBA Jam, and the He's on Fire, of course, will always go down in infamy. I was hoping, you know, you talked about Shaq and all these NBA players who were gravitating to this, but it reached a fervor that video games just don't. I mean, maybe some Maddens would have a lot of build up to their releases and things like that today, but the way that it caught fire, what was kind of the craziest anecdote that you ran across? And I did use that on purpose, caught fire. The craziest anecdote that you ran across in terms of how wild its popularity got.
Wow. I'd say, I mean, there's a few things. So just offhand, to get an idea of NBA Jam success, I always use Jurassic Park as a comparison point. So, of course, Jurassic Park in 1993, the biggest movie. I mean, Jurassic Park is everywhere, the merchandise, everyone's going to go see it. It's this huge, huge thing. And in that year, Jurassic Park made, I think it was something like $346 million at the box office, which is a lot of money. That's a ton of money. And Jurassic Park is on top of the movie world at that point. And NBA Jam, meanwhile, an arcade game, earned $1 billion. $1 billion wow. in quarters / tokens. So that is one at a time, which I think amounts to 4 billion coins. Crazy to think about. I mean, can you imagine 4 billion coins, what that would look like?
Yeah.
But I mean, that was just how popular NBA Jam was, that people were lining up to play it. And I mean, these players wanted to be part of it. I mean, yeah, like you mentioned, like a popularity of a thing like Madden is something that you could probably find nowadays, but not to that degree. And also in the early 90s, video games were looked at very differently. I mean, nowadays, if you see like an athlete posting on social media, oh, you know, hanging out and playing, whatever, that's not that big of a deal. It's cool, but it's not that big of a deal. But back then, like the idea that your NBA, those NBA players you love are spending their own time on a video game is just staggering. And, you know, you mentioned the Shaq story earlier. That's one of my favorite parts of the book, is the idea of how much Shaq loves NBA Jam.
Yeah.
So he was a really big fan. And yeah, like you were talking about the Magic. So the classic Magic squad of Nick Anderson and Scott Skiles and Penny Hardaway and Shaq, they would all get off the bus. And then Shaq or somebody else would announce, okay, NBA Jam tournament in the room at 10. You know, be there, be square. And they would all gather up in somebody's hotel room and play NBA Jam on the Genesis. And they would throw money in the pot. And they would all be, you know, bantering back and forth and hanging out. And I mean, they're spending their free time playing this game in which they're actually in. I mean, that's just like such a, that just blows my mind, like spending the time to do that when you're this hugely famous and hugely powerful athlete. But yeah, that was the effect it had. So, I mean, NBA Jam really crossed all kinds of lines. I mean, people were telling me stories. An artist on the game told me a story of being on honeymoon in Italy. And he was just walking down the street, this was in 94 or so, and he, you know, he and his fiance, or rather he and his wife, saw this, actually, no, this one was his fiance, that was a different story about the honeymoon. He and his fiance were in Italy, and he saw this arcade, so he decided to pop his head in and see what they had. And when he popped his head in, there was NBA Jam, and people were surrounding it. And he was just on a trip with his fiance over in Italy. And, I mean, it was just worldwide. And, I mean, my story itself is another testament to how popular NBA Jam was. I grew up in Karachi, Pakistan, and I only had to play NBA Jam on consoles. They didn't have the arcade version over there, but I loved it. And that was on the Sega Mega Drive, the Sega Genesis over there. But, I mean, that's just how popular it was. I mean, worldwide, making a ton of money, the players loving it. And there's so many amazing stories. I mean, you could keep going on all day.
So I'm curious about after NBA Jam comes out, it goes crazy, and then they have the idea to, you know, add it to the consoles, which is how I played it most and how you played it most. And it's immensely popular there. Tournament Edition is great because it adds some new features to it. And I think had I been an adult at the time, my expectation would have been, oh, they'll keep pumping out NBA Jams every year and adding new things to it, and then it will have this long legacy the way a Madden does or something like that. But that didn't really happen. NBA Hangtime comes out. NFL Blitz is awesome, and I still play that for Sega Dreamcast at time to time. Hangtime is fun. You could create players and things like that, the 64 version, but it didn't have the same sort of way that it captured people's imaginations that NBA Jam did. Why wasn't it able to be recreated year after year? Why did it kind of end up being this thing that's all-time classic and people still know to this day, but it didn't, I guess, continue the way that I would have expected it to?
That's a great question. I think that really stems from the fact that NBA Jam is so over the top in the first place. I mean, if you're trying to make a simulation game and you're trying to make the game as realistic as possible, there's an almost infinite amount of things you can do with it. You can keep finding ways to tweak it and to add to it. Okay, what's something else they do in real life that's on the game? What's another camera angle? What's another detail?
Yeah.
You know, what can we do to go in and really flesh that out? I mean, this is why, in some ways, you can keep going forever with simulation. Both an arcade game, like an over-the-top arcade game like NBA Jam, you're pretty much relying on that whole concept. I mean, you need it to be fast-paced, over-the-top, fun, big, bright. And then, you know, as much as I love NBA Jam, as much as everybody Jam, I think there was some burnout after a while because the game did so well and was so popular. There were some knockoffs, there was some sequels, there were some not great sequels, that I just don't think it would be able to sustain that popularity. So I think an NBA Jam every 5-10 years would be sustainable because you would have enough time for it to feel fresh again. But year after year, there's only so much you can do with NBA Jam. Whereas, you know, I'm not surprised that simulation games ended up beating those arcade-style games because those simulation games you can do so much with. I mean, what is Madden going to look like 10 years from now? You can think of all these different things it could be doing. Mm-hmm. Whereas when if you think of what NBA Jam would look like now if it was still a thing, you couldn't imagine it in the same way. You'd really be reliant on those game developers coming up with some really creative, fun things. And I don't think that there was enough there for them to dig from.
No, that's a great point. And just being able to create a player, I used to put a wolf head on my guy on NBA Hangtime. And, you know, it's fun, but making the guys a little bit bigger on the court and small things like that, it wasn't enough to say, oh, yeah, this is as classic as Jam because it was so unique at that time. That's a really good point that simulation games have a lot more areas to grow. Can we talk about our favorite matchups, our favorite combinations? I know that I used every single one, and I got to be so good at one point that I would use D. Brown and Robert Parrish, and I would beat people with them. They couldn't shoot threes at all. I mean, Parrish was the big man who could knock you down, and Brown could steal the ball from you, but you basically had to dunk every time and hope that nobody blocked your dunk or stole the ball away from you. It was all about efficiency at scoring at the rim, is what I'm saying with those guys.
That's fantastic.
But what were some of your favorite combinations of NBA Jam players?
Wow, man, there's so many great ones. So when it comes back to my all-time favorites, I have to go with two of the cliches, but I think those are cliches for a reason. I mean, they're classics for a reason and cliches for a reason. So when it comes to the original, my all-time favorite is Stockton Malone. I mean, Naturally. Those were guys who were really important to NBA Jam history, too. It's crazy to think that at one point NBA Jam was filled with players that all played the exact same. I mean, so much of what you think about now is based on stats. Oh, that guy can shoot threes. That guy can dunk. This guy can steal. This guy's fast. But at one point, they're all the exact same. And it wasn't until somebody in the arcade said, hey, you know, don't let Stockton get near the ball or else we'll steal it, and that one of the developers said, hey, you know, we should probably make the game so that players are different from one another. And that's Karl Malone isn't stealing like John Stockton, and John Stockton isn't dunking like Karl Malone. So they're important to the history, but plus, I mean, what a great combination, that big man, small man combo. I feel like it was perfected right there. So I love them. When it comes to tournament edition, love Kevin Payton, classic. I love Barkley appearing in the games. So I love Barkley and Dan Majerle. I also have a soft spot for Shaq in the game. I think he's with Scott Skiles, maybe. The first one, I'm really bad for not remembering this offhand.
Well, there's
probably, yeah.
So in the Super Nintendo, you get, I think, Nick Anderson and Scott Skiles, and it always bothered me that Nick Anderson did not have a good 3-point rating. Like, wait, how does he not have a good 3-point rating? You missed on this one.
Oh yeah, and those guys at Midway actually kind of winged it on some of those stats. Mm-hmm. There were just two of them. Actually, Termel was one of the two people that would do it. The other one was the sound designer, John Hay. There were only a couple of sports guys on the video game team, and what they would do is they'd scan box scores and go through the headlines, see what was going on.
That's right. Why didn't they Google it?
Which is why Mike Isolino ended up there. I'm sorry?
I said, why didn't they Google it, was the joke.
Exactly. They should have just done that. That would have made life so much easier. But yeah, I mean, this is how they had to do. They had to put it together in all these sources. So that's how Mike Isolino ended up on the Dallas Mavericks. And that's one thing, that's another part of NBA Jam lore, like this player who's not very good, isn't really remembered for much else besides being in NBA Jam. But I was reading someplace that even he was recognized after he was in NBA Jam. And this is like just a one-off character somewhere, a one-off player somewhere. But yeah, there's so many great players in there. It's one of those things, the more I talk about it, the more I'll remember. I mean, I just love so many of them. I mean, I love that. Even though they weren't the best, I always had a soft spot for the T-Wolves. Man, there's just...
Leitner and Chuck Person, not the best combo, though, for a Jam, if you want to win.
Not the best combo, no. But nice in theory, and it's always cool to see Minnesota on the court. The Knicks also. Patrick Ewing and John Starks, great combo. I mean, there's just, yeah, I'm probably blanking on some big ones offhand.
Well, the,
of course,
Larry,
yeah,
John-
Larry, and Grant.
Larry Johnson, Zoe Morning is a great one. I mean, that's,
ooh,
if
that's
you want to,
great,
if you want to get
a
tough,
really
yeah.
good one.
Yep.
Yeah. Oh yeah. And then Muggsy Bogues shows up in tournament edition. Oh, classic, classic combos. I mean, there's just so many. I mean, thinking about NBA Jam, like you go back to the roster of the original game, there's all these different members of the Dream Team, all of these future all-stars. Mm-hmm. It was really just such a packed game and such a special time for basketball that, I mean, I'm not surprised that like we can keep going and going with all those good teams.
Right. And I think that's the another major factor of why it became so iconic is that time in the NBA. Now you have Bird and Magic had started the momentum and then Jordan comes in. But even when Jordan goes away to play baseball for a couple of years, the players who filled the gaps there were all great. And like you said, the Dream Team plays a role in this. There's so many, there's like legends of the 80s going out with legends of the 90s coming in. And you have your, let's see, who would have played? Was it Vinny Del Negro and David Robinson? I mean, there's just so many superstars. And then it's Jam, and you have all the big men of the time. Now the big men shoot threes. And Carl,
yeah, Hakeem?
Right.
Yeah.
Carl Anthony Towns won't even bump into anybody during a game. But back then, I mean, they used to slam people, and they used to have the big guys. And I just think it was such a great time for the NBA that the interest was sort of starting to ascend and peak in the NBA's history, which probably also played a role here.
Absolutely, absolutely. And then you've got that tied into Michael Jordan being as popular and as phenomenal as he was. I mean, yeah, just talking about it, I'm thinking of more, like the Rockets with Hakeem the Dream on there. He was great. I mean, you've
Vernon
got
Vernon Maxwell,
so
I
many.
Think, right?
Yeah, I think it was Vernon Maxwell. Casey Smith showed up in a future one, but yeah, bro, it's probably Vernon Maxwell for that first one. But, I mean, there's just so many of them. You've got, yeah, the Dream Team element. Of course, you've got the Bulls over there with Pippen and Grant. I mean, there's just so many things going over there for NBA Jam, but that roster is such a special thing. And I think that when people look back on the game fondly, it isn't just because it's a great game, but it's because they see all these familiar faces and they really associate with that time. And having a game that had all those faces of those famous players in there and then their actual likenesses in the game, that was a rarity. So it really has a special place in so many people's heart because of all those kinds of things.
So last thing for you, just writing this book, you kind of lived out something that would have been a dream of mine to interview Shaq about NBA Jam, right? I mean, that's pretty darn cool. You just give me some of your favorite parts of spending a very big chunk of your life on NBA Jam and telling that story.
Absolutely. Boy, I could honestly really go on all day in terms of really good stories from the book because I've been so lucky to have so many experiences, but just a few offhand, I ended up calling up Shaq for my interview with him when I was at work. So at my day job, I work with insurance agents and I've been trying to track down Shaq for months. And then his agent says, okay, you know, he's ready to talk. He can do it today. I'm like, oh, thank goodness. So I had this call with the insurance agent that I had to push off. I was like, oh, I'm so sorry, Jeff. I have to reschedule. And
I have to talk
Jeff
to Shaq.
I reschedule.
Now, there's an excuse that no one's going to buy.
Yeah. Right. Exactly. It's just such an outlandish thing. But I was like, could I tell this guy that? But I didn't tell him. I just had to reschedule. Something came up. So then I went to this little huddle room at my work, and I sat there and I waited right at the time for Shaq to call. And I was just, you know, I don't really get too nervous about doing interviews with famous people anymore because I've been doing it for so long. And also, you know, I think it's part of that, you know, you should try to compose yourself the best you can.
Sure.
But I mean, I was like, oh, I'm about to talk to Shaq. This is amazing. So I was getting a little giddy over there. But then no call came. And I was like, man, okay. So then I texted his agent, hey, you know, I've been waiting for a little bit. What's up? She's like, oh, he hasn't called you? Give him 1 second. And then right then, unknown caller shows up on my cell phone and I pick it up and goes, hello. Oh my God, it's Shaq. He's calling me at work. This is amazing. And then my butterflies went away pretty quickly. I was really scared, but I was also like, man, I got to really hone in on this and get as much good content as I can for the book and learn whatever I can. But he was, so keep in mind, I'm in Columbus, Ohio. I was at my day job in downtown Columbus, Ohio. And, or rather in the neck of the woods of downtown. And Shaq was somewhere in Florida. He was in his car. So he was on the car speakerphone talking to me. And he was pulling out of the driveway as this was happening. And you know how, like, if you leave your door open or you don't plug in your seatbelt, your car make like a ding, ding, ding sound. Yeah. And yeah, so he had that sound. He's like, what's that? And I was like, yeah, man, hey, have you checked your seatbelt? Maybe your door's open. I was like, man, this is so weird. Like, what is my life? Like, talking to Shaq from Columbus, Ohio. I had to do a call to this insurance agent. I'm talking to Shaq. He's called me up. I'm about to talk to him about NBA Jam. I'm like, man, life is so weird sometimes. It's pretty cool, but it's pretty weird. But Shaq was a pleasure to talk to. And the fact that he gave me so much time and so much good material really was a testament to how much he loved NBA Jam. I mean, I'm still pretty unknown guy. I'm still totally unknown until this book came out. And he, you know, went into some great stories of, you know, talking about the Orlando Magic playing NBA Jam together, playing NBA Jam at his house. He did an impression. He did a boom shakalaka, which was pretty cool. He had some really great insight about why he doesn't really like to play sports games so much anymore or video games as much anymore is because of all the menus you have to go through and how much you have to learn.
Totally agree.
Pick up and play style.
Totally agree, yeah. Shaq.
And it was amazing. And then we got to talk about Shaq Fu for a little bit, which he assured me did very well. Don't worry about that. He like made a lot of money off of it. Probably not the best game, but he did fine. We talked about some other stuff too, but it was just the coolest thing. And I was thinking like, wow, this is one of those singular experiences that I'm going to have. You know, I'm lucky enough to talk to an all-time great about a subject I love that I'm working on. And it's all because of NBA Jam. And that was one of my, probably my happiest memories or my most vivid memories is of stepping out of that room. And all my coworkers at this point had known that I was going to talk to Shaq.
Right.
Because I told them, I'm going to go talk to Shaq. And then they're like, did you talk to him? And I was like, yes, I did. And I played them the recording and they're like, oh my God, it's really him. It's really Shaq. It was super cool. And it was a really great moment. That was my favorite memory offhand in terms of working on the book, but I had so many others. Like I got to talk to DJ Jazzy Jeff, also from the parking lot of my work. I got to talk to George Clinton from Parliament of the Funkadelic. It was so cool to talk to him about NBA Jam. I mean, he said to me that in the game he thought it wasn't the ball that was on fire. He thought his hair was on fire. He said his grandkids had told him that his hair was on fire in NBA Jam. And, I mean, this is P-Funk we're talking about.
Yeah.
So I didn't have the heart to break it to him that it's actually the ball and not his hair. But it was still a really cool little anecdote anyways. And, I mean, those are just some of the special guest sorts. Got to really know the development team and talk to them for hours. You know, I would – Tramiel lives on the West Coast. I'm on the East Coast, on East Coast time. And I would have to – on a Friday night, I'd have to go to bed and wake up at 1 in the morning because I'd be really tired. I'd wake up at 1 in the morning and Tramiel would have gotten out of the gym at 10 o'clock and would want to talk to me. So I'd be doing interviews at all times, mornings, you know, afternoons, late nights if need be, whenever I could. So it was really a crazy experience, definitely very singular, 4 years of work on it, but it was worth it in the end to put it all together and to make a whole cohesive story out of it.
Well,
but some of those interviews were amazing.
It absolutely paid off. NBA Jam, the book, is amazing, and that's where you can find it on Twitter, is at NBA Jam Book. That's how I became aware of this project, and I waited for months as you tweeted out different teasers, and then when it finally came out, I put it on the Christmas list and read it in about a 2 or 3 hours. I mean, just, you know, blasting through it because there's so many great stories in this book. So I highly suggest that if you are a millennial who loved the NBA as a child and loved saying he's on fire when you shot threes at the park, this would be a book for you for sure. So Rayan Ali, this is one of my favorite conversations that I've had on this show. And the reason that I started it, to connect with people that I normally wouldn't interview while I'm covering an NFL beat, to just sort of dip into other interests. And this was fantastic. I'm so happy we were able to get together.
I had a great time. Thank you so much for having me, man. It was a pleasure.
Yeah, for sure. Where's the best place to get NBA Jam the book?
Yeah, so you can look it up on Amazon. Just look up NBA Jam book. You'll be able to find it. Otherwise, you can go to bossfightbooks.com. That's my publisher's site. It's out now in paperback and in digital. So you can get it on your Kindle, get it on your Nook. You could get a little paperback version. And even if you want an autographed copy, just find me on Twitter at NBA Jam book. If you've got a Twitter account, send me a DM or email me nbajambook@gmail.com. My copies that I'm doing myself are $23 USD, includes shipping. And yeah, I'll send over an autographed copy and some cards and whatnot too. But yeah, just look it up on Amazon if nothing else. You just look up NBA Jam Book, you'll find me.
Well, this was super fun. I'm really glad we could catch up. And maybe someday, if we're ever in the same city, we'll play NBA Jam, and I will beat you with Dee Brown and Robert Parrish. So
absolutely, you will. I'm not very good. People get a lot of pleasure out of that, though. They're like, oh, I beat the guy who wrote the NBA Jam book at NBA Jam. And I'm like, it's not that good of a feat as when you know how bad I am at the game. I love it, but I'm not that good.
Well, you could spend your next 4 years practicing, and maybe
absolutely, that's the next 4 years.
Maybe someday you could play Shaq at NBA Jam. Book is the Twitter account again. Make sure you go follow him, Rayan Ali. Excellent work. And this has been another episode of Off the Record. We'll catch you next time.